Saturdays Live, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, March 18, 2017. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Later on in the program, we're going to talk about a trend away from having brick-and-mortar offices and what it's going to do to businesses and realtors and office rent and, heck, the price of parking. And this is I've got a different take on this. I think that this isn't just a question of technology and a question of lower demand for real estate. I think there's a shift in the culture that I haven't heard talked about much in any media, and I want to spend a couple of minutes on that later on today. So that's coming up on today's program. We're pretty careful about who we ask to be on this show. The purpose of this program is to help people navigate through life, because I think there's altogether too little of that instruction as we grow up in school and in our culture and certainly in the media today. I don't think that people get what they need in terms of looking at the news, knowing how to interpret it, looking at finance, knowing how to interpret it, figuring out whether to get married or not, who to marry, how to decide that, whether to have children or not, and then how to raise them, how to grow old, how to make plans financially, socially, to get to be older and go through the various passages of life. I think there's a shortage, not of information. There's way too much information. There's a shortage of good information, or a sifting or siphoning of information into an understandable form. And so I try to have folks on here, experts in every field, to talk about things. And it's rare also. There are a handful of people who we ask back over time. But today, I am absolutely delighted to welcome back for a fourth time to the show a man named Jim Mascara. Jim, welcome back to TalkRadio1.com.
Thanks, Steve. I guess I'm very honored for you to have me on again.
Well, and I'm honored that you're back here with me. The two books that we talked about the last two times that you've been on the show, one was Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During the Financial Crisis. Another one is Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. And these two books have been nonfiction accounts of the financial crisis and what individuals can do to protect their wealth and navigate that crisis. And there are all sorts of things. You go back, ladies and gentlemen, and hear those interviews on March 26, 2011, October 4, 2014, May 9, 2015, and Jim and I carved up a lot of things in those. There's a lot of good stuff in there about your money, your future, and what it can mean. It's also, I think, interesting to go back and hear, Jim, your perspective and mine as we were discussing it back then, and how much of what we said turned out, I think, to be pretty accurate in terms of a prediction of where we are today. Now, though, you've written a novel. What made you decide to, in fact, you've written two novels. What made you decide to shift and write novels when you had been writing nonfiction?
Well, you know, reminiscing, I guess, on the time that we spent, you mentioned 2011, 2014, and 2015. You know, in 2008, 2009, we kind of entered the edge of that hurricane, and we've probably been in the eye of the hurricane right now for, you know, arguably 3, 4, 5 years, maybe a little bit longer. And now I think we're going to push over into that other edge. And it strikes me that sometimes it's difficult to, and it's kind of interesting that you were mentioning this when you were prefacing, you know, the entrance to your show, that there's so much information out there, but people have a hard time sifting through it. And part of that is critical analysis of, you know, what you're looking at and how to interpret it. And it struck me that sometimes trying to convey information in nonfiction text is maybe not, let's say, entertaining enough. And, you know, in the age of 140 characters, somebody made a comment to me, I guess, in the summer of 15. They said, yeah, you know, we saw your book and all that, but Jim, people want to be entertained. And I thought, well, how's a way that I can combine, you know, some of the precepts that I had laid forth in the Escaping Oz series and kind of put that into something that's entertaining, obviously, you know, in a fictional setting, but then even throw more into it where, you know, you mix in some things that I talked about in the book that are more than just financial, right? And if you look at what are, say, some of the salient themes that you hear on the news today. Obviously, the financial crisis for many people, I guess you could argue that it's still around because the distribution of wealth is not equal, and obviously it's not how many people would want. So the financial crisis still lingers for some. You also have politics. Obviously, we came through a very contentious 2016 election, and another theme that you're hearing more and more of, which again is very prominently featured in the book series, are cyber threats. And, you know, that's manifesting, as cyber terror, attacks on people individually or on financial institutions, infrastructure, and so forth. So really kind of the impetus was what I had written about before, taking some current events and then just projecting them just a little bit into the future, maybe just a handful of years to where people can relate to it and think, that's something that I really could see happening.
My guest is Jim Mascara. He has a Bachelor of Science degree and a Master's of Science degree in Industrial Engineering from the University of Missouri, and he's a principal at Sentinel Consulting, which is a business restructuring and capital acquisition firm. Sentinel Consulting restructures debt and increases liquidity to keep small businesses alive and well. So it's from this very practical engineering background and economic background that Jim makes his comments. Jim, you said that that we need to entertain, and you're absolutely right. I think Walt Disney said you have no idea how much you can teach to people if they don't know they're being taught. And I will comment on the book. I have not finished it, but I'm well into it, and it's compelling. It's a fascinating thing, and it causes me to think just as much about these concepts and issues as any nonfiction book would. So you've achieved the entertainment factor, I would tell you.
Good.
When you said we were at one point, we were in the eye of the hurricane, and now we're getting ready to push to the other edge, do you see us now headed into some form of recession again?
Yeah, I mean, what you see right now, and I'm a big proponent in using social mood, I guess, as a barometer, for how economies will function. And right now, I think this would be very, very hard to argue with, is that, 2015, 2016, the prelude, and then of course the election itself. I mean, that's probably as contentious as anything that we've had since many of us have been alive, and it sets the tone for what you're going to see going forward. And the battle right now that you see between obviously left and right, what is now called liberal and what is now called conservative, I mean, it's at the forefront. And it's really interesting, I think, for me to see that on a day-to-day basis. And right now you're seeing another manifestation of what I called in my nonfiction text, the intersection of politics and economics, when you see the first Trump budget. And a lot of contention about that. And now we've started a cycle where you're going to see interest rates start to increase again. You've got stock markets that are historically, much more overvalued than they have been before, certainly in the last time you and I spoke. So you're right there at the precipice. And the question always becomes, what is the snowflake that's going to cause the remainder of the avalanche? And that's typically what happens in crises. Crises emerge very, very slowly at first, and then it happens suddenly. So when that avalanche starts to build, the snow hits the side of the mountain, but we don't know exactly what that last snowflake is going to be to then actually start the avalanche.
It would be foolish as well as incorrect for anyone to take the position that we're not going to have a recession again at all. I think that it is entirely predictable that we're ready for one now since the last recession officially ended in 2009. And although it's been an extremely weak recovery affecting the recovery has not affected enough Americans. You have a tremendous and growing disparity between the poor and the rich, and the jobs that have been created are mainly in the food service industry and generally make around $20,000 a year. It's really been a problem. And yet, I do think you're right. I think we're headed into another recession, and the signs are there with increasing interest rates. The stock market, as you pointed out, levitating around Dow at around 21,000, in and out of the 21,000 mark. So I think we have that coming around the corner. Now, that's going to happen over the next few years. Your book takes place in 2020. Let's shift to that for a minute. And would you provide us with a general outline? Give us the basic storyline of that political thriller, 2020.
So you start by, you know, creating a backdrop of some things that have happened, you know, within the economy of the United States. So as a matter of fact, the precept of the book is, you know, the Dow Jones plunges a lot, Shanghai Composite drops a lot, you know, Illinois state employees have a riot after deep wage cuts. You know, Illinois is obviously going through a lot of problems. You know, the big three automakers lay off thousands of employees. So you have that. You have mutual funds struggling with redemptions. So that's kind of the financial backdrop, you know, going into it. Stock market recovered. And I introduce the protagonist of the series. His name is Chandler Scott, and he's a young journalist, and he's working for an international news network. And what he does is he's got his own show, and he interviews people in the political and financial realm. And it's an international news network. It's based out of Buenos Aires, Argentina. And so it kind of gives him a little bit of different perspective. He's able to operate a little bit more freely. As he progresses through the book, you get introduced to his mentor. So there's a very strong mentor, I guess, mentee relationship that goes on during the book. And for some people, it might the first book might labor for them a little bit, but part of that's to try to establish the pedigree of a mentor, and then there's a mystery character that comes up that actually ends up being his mentor also. So during the process of going through this book, the stock market experiences another crash, and the reader gets to kind of see, you know, how it affects people personally. You know, his mom is part of the story, and you know, she's a single mom raising him by herself, obviously. And she's struggling, and as other people are. So he kind of gets into that part of it. There's a love story that starts to develop. And throughout the course of when all of this is happening, you know, people, and this is something that kind of some of these social themes that get transmitted through some of the characters is there's the issue of, you know, what people want out of government when a crisis hits, in this case being a financial crisis, and then throw on top of that cyber crises as well. So you've got cyber crises, you've got, you know, financial crises, and then you've got people that want the government to do more. And then, you know, Chandler's mentor is somebody that is probably more libertarian and bent, and he's actually advocating that the government do less. And so all of this moves into the election of 2020. You've got third parties, I mean, viable third parties that that came to fruition in 2016 and then 2018 that are challenging, you know, at the state level, Senate level, House of Representatives level, and now at the presidential level. So the 2020 election then will actually have more than just two parties running. And when I say that, I don't mean like Ross Perot in 1992 or here last, you know, in the last election. I mean, these are parties that will actually win electoral college votes. They'll win states. And so while all that's going on, there are shadow organizations that are working behind the scenes that are trying to – I mean, they're trying to do the same thing. They're trying to bring order to the U.S. economy. But whenever that happens, there's additional layers of authority that then get placed over everybody, and there's more of a culture of surveillance. And so that's what Chandler kind of battles, he discovers, and then the book ends really with a pretty big bombshell.
Which we won't reveal.
Which we will not reveal.
You talk about a cyber crisis, and we're going to talk about that cyber crisis. In fact, that's exactly what I want to do. When my conversation continues with Jim Mosqueira, we're live from Los Angeles. I'm Stephen Spear. This is TalkRadio1.com, and this book is fun, it's thought-provoking, and it's compelling. So you can buy it right here, right now, on the TalkRadio1.com website, and I would encourage that. Back in less than 60 seconds, this is TalkRadio1.com.
Truly fascinating stuff. More coming up in less than a minute on The Stephen Spearer Show, right here on TalkRadio1.com.
Here's a fun game to play. What don't they sell at Amazon.com? With deep discounts on the stuff you buy most, delivered free when you spend just $25, and in most states, no tax. Plus, it's easy to help support the fine programming here on Talk Radio 1 without costing you a penny extra. Just use our link before you shop Amazon. We get a small percentage. Your friends and family, if they use our link, we might be able to afford some new windscreens. And then if they told two friends to use our link, we could afford a toll-free number. And then if they told two friends, we could afford a lavish party for listeners. And if those people all told two of their friends, we could buy a Talk Radio 1 corporate jet. And if they told two of their friends, then we could afford our own island in the Caribbean where all the hosts could live and broadcast like one big happy family. And then if they told two friends, world domination. You see, it starts with just your purchases on Amazon.com through our link here on TalkRadio1.com.
We now return to the Stephen Spearer Show, celebrating life through personal growth on TalkRadio1.com.
I am Stephen Spear. This is TalkRadio1.com. My guest is Jim Mascara, author of 2020, which is available here on the TalkRadio1.com website. Click on it and you will own it. Jim, you talk about a cyber crisis. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, right now I think that the cyber threats, I guess, have been accentuated more by, you know, what happened with the DNC's server, you know, prior to the election. Now there's other, you know, allegations about, you know, maybe the presidency being involved somehow in collusion with the Russians and so forth. Cyber terror is something that I talk about in the book that will become more. I mean, this is actually very predictive. It will become more common. I mean, I think you hear about it now sometimes in the news. A lot of times it's underreported because people obviously have a shame and embarrassment about what's going on. The cyber threats that I talk about in the book 2020 actually are those that start affecting infrastructure. They affect the financial markets directly and indirectly. Sometime during the book, actually, Chandler experiences a couple of them. And what's interesting is there's a group that is called Omni that is kind of a reviled, enigmatic hacker organization. They're some almost like Robin Hood. They're friend to some and foe to others. And they've been accused sometimes of doing causing cyber mayhem in different parts of the world. But at the same time, they've actually almost in a WikiLeaks way, sometimes they uncover information. Other times they stop organizations that they think are, let's say, hurting the poor and the disadvantaged. So they're really an enigma. But you will see cyber attacks becoming more prominent. There's also kinetic terror attacks that occur. So part of the reason for doing all that is because whenever something like that happens, society wants protection from it. And it's back to kind of that attention that's prevalent in the book, which is Chandler trying to discover, you know, the pros and cons of people wanting freedom from something as opposed to freedom of, which is, you know, guaranteed constitutionally. So the cyber threat actually overlays that struggle that, you know, that Chandler deals with in the book.
I, as a practicing real estate and business attorney, we represent about 25 or so escrow companies, and the cyber terror that's occurring there is just stunning, where people are sending their money according to emails that they've gotten. They wire money into escrow, and it turns out they didn't. They wired it out of the country, and it'll never be seen again. We're seeing this happen more often where there's hacking so that someone who's about to wire money then gets wiring instructions, which are false. Money goes into a bank account and then out. And of course, the bank has no liability. Someone just opened a bank account and then closed it after the money came in and went out. And so we're seeing those sorts of things. And it's not gotten the press attention that I think it should. It's mentioned and they talk about it, but it's generally when a giant company gets hacked and, you know, 60,000 identities get stolen. But it's not this individual just tragedy. The identity theft is very inconvenient. It can be dangerous, but there are financial tragedies that have occurred. People have lost life savings now through that sort of thing. Distinguish between cyber terror and kinetic terror.
So the cyber terror are, you know, those events like you were just mentioning, you know, with your escrow companies. The crime, if you will, the mayhem exists within the internet. And of course, you know, the internet is something that I develop a little bit further in the book 2020, which, you know, the internet actually has three different layers. You know, the first layer are the things that when you go into your web browser, you know, you type www.something and then magic happens and then you obviously arrive at a website. There's others that exist that are part of the hidden web, which you can get to, but you have to know a physical numerical address about how to get there. And then there's what's called the dark web or the deep web. Dark net is a term that I use. And that's where, you know, today there was, I guess today, but most recently, the dark web probably came into prominence in the traditional media with something called Silk Road. So the dark web is associated with a lot of illicit activity that occurs, you know, child pornography, you know, buying and selling of arms, drugs, etc. And that web exists, again, more covertly, but it's very, very active. And that actually becomes a very important part of the book 2020, because this hacker organization that I mentioned earlier, Omni, they operate within that realm. And so there's almost like a different kind of economy that works there. And I created a virtual currency that I call DigiNote that is kind of the preferred currency of the people that operate there and even those that operate in the more conventional web. So that's kind of the cyber realm. So all things that can happen that that attack you know, traditional websites. It goes further now as you hear more and more about something called the Internet of Things, where it can then, you know, penetrate or permeate, you know, your home where you've got, you know, a refrigerator or something else that's, you know, the more devices you have connected to the Internet, actually, the more insecure you're going to become. There's attacks that will occur that in the books, actually all of them, on infrastructure. You know, whether that's power plants, you know, water plants, et cetera. Kinetic terror are the things that probably more people are afraid of, which, again, that's some sort of a physical event, whether it's an attack on human beings, you know, explosions, you know, missiles, dirty bombs, et cetera. That's more the kinetic event. And the combination of the two events makes people kind of, you know, have that need to have that freedom from. So I want to be free from terror. And so in order for the more and more people ask the government to do in the book, the more layers of authority, you know, will be kind of foisted upon them. And then that, you know, kind of becomes a challenge also where, you know, people have to weigh, you know, what they want, you know, authority versus freedom, because, you know, the more you get of one, the less you'll get of the other.
I spoke with a friend of mine in the run-up to this show, and I told him I was having you on and what we'd be talking about. And he said, you know, all this isn't very important to me. He said, I told him about the escrow money disappearing. He said, I'm not buying or selling a house. And listen, if someone hijacks my internet-connected refrigerator, what are they going to do, make my food too cold or too warm? How bad is that? Why do I really care? Can't I just ignore this? Is essentially what he said. What would you tell him?
No, I mean, here's the thing, and I look at this also from there's a lot of security devices now, you know, like home security alarms and so forth, and they talk about, well, you know, you can control this from, you know, you control this from your phone, and you know, once I hear about things like that, you know, you're actually creating an entryway into your home when that happens. And again, I'm not decrying that anybody should be wary of the Internet of Things and they shouldn't buy, you know, internet connected refrigerators or TV and so forth. I mean, I don't have an internet connected refrigerator, but I have, you know, a television that's connected to the internet because I'll download something from Amazon through that. But just people need to understand what that means. You know, you create an opening into your home network when you do that, and that's inescapable. Now, the question then becomes, you know, how secure are you from a hardware perspective, from a software perspective? You know, do you have the latest patching and so forth? And one thing that is really, really curious, and I'm glad you mentioned this, in the second book in the series, which is called Rebellion, which I released at the end of last year, one of the things that I revealed there is it's really funny, but it just came out in the latest WikiLeaks revelation, which is that when there are software vulnerabilities, so we, you know, your friend was talking about, you know, having a refrigerator connected to the internet, why does it care? Well, anytime something's connected to the internet, there's some software associated with it, or some operating system associated with it. There are a number of software vulnerabilities that exist. You know, it's pick a number of devices, and a lot of times the spy agencies, they'll just leave it kind of generically like that. They'll discover that. but they will not, they won't raise their hand and say, oh, Google, we found X vulnerability in this version of Chrome, or we found this vulnerability Microsoft in this version of Microsoft Office. They'll actually let that be. And part of the reason for that is once they discover those vulnerabilities, they know that software gets disseminated not just in the United States, but overseas as well. So that gives them an entree into that. Well, hackers understand this too. And when these software vulnerabilities are discovered, and they could be discovered by a hacking organization, by an intelligence organization, they do not get revealed or announced or disclosed to the software company. So that could be Google with Chrome, you know, Microsoft with one of the Office products. I mean, you name it, there's all kinds of software out there. And so that's something that I actually bring up in the second book, Rebellion, where when these exploits, you know, when these exploits remain, nobody says anything about it because it gives an entree then to intelligence agencies and hackers and so forth. So that creates kind of even more of a problem, you know, for people using software. And in the second book, it's interesting because it becomes much more of an issue because there are, you know, tragedies associated with, you know, with those vulnerabilities.
You know, you raise the question of how realistic would it be to see politics and economics collide. I can't imagine that they don't collide. They appear to me to be directly tied. What's your view?
I think you're seeing that front and center right now with the Trump budget. All right, when the Trump budget director was making some announcements about what was being cut, everybody raised their hand. Well, don't cut this because of, you know, fill in the blank. And what's interesting about that is that those budget cuts that are being proposed are actually the easy. I mean, that's the low hanging fruit, right? That doesn't even address anything with respect to the entitlements, which, you know, you've got what, probably 2/3 of the budget, maybe right now, that's maybe even more than that, which is actually preordained, you know, predestined for something. So it's not touchable. And I read a book recently which actually talked about that, you know, as a country, we're losing a lot of dynamism because, you know, so much is already just preset, particularly from a budget perspective. And I took that to heart. And again, that what you're seeing, really interesting now, what's one of the things he's asked for is what? More money for the military, more money for the Department of Homeland Security. Just fits in really, really well with the book 2020, because what do I talk about there? More authority. Well, how do you layer more authority if you're the government? Well, you need more surveillance. You know, you need more people watching. You know, you've got that, you know, that eye of Sauron, you know, that's basically looking out over society. And so that's part of Chandler's struggle in the first book, which is, you know, how do you weigh that? You know, is it good or is it bad? And you know, what are the consequences? You know, what's that last snowflake that hits and then creates the avalanche, which you see in the second book, Rebellion, you know, that says, you know, some parts of society said, that's enough. I can't take this anymore. And so because of, you know, all of this layering of surveillance, authority, et cetera, I'm going to do X. And, you know, you'll see more of that in the second book.
Well, and what it leads to, all of this leads to the formation of third parties. And that is something that you explore pretty well. I want to talk about that next. And that's what we'll do when my conversation continues with Jim Mosqueira, the author of 2020, a book you can buy by clicking on it here on the TalkRadio1.com website, a compelling novel. I would recommend it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Stephen Spear. We're live from Los Angeles. We'll be back in less than 60 seconds. This is TalkRadio1.com.
Steve will be back in less than 60 seconds. If anyone should ask, you're listening to The Stephen Spearer Show on TalkRadio1.com.
Listeners to Talk Radio 1 have been asking, besides using the Amazon.com link before you buy, how can we support the fine programming on Talk Radio 1? Well, now you can. You see that link on the right side of the Talk Radio 1 homepage that says Donate to TRO? You can make a one-time donation of any amount, or you can give us a couple bucks every month. No long-term commitment. You can unsubscribe anytime. Our goal is to keep the live show streaming at no cost, and we can only do that with your help. As broadcast radio becomes more predictable and fewer voices dominate, Talk Radio 1 strives to present more shows with a larger variety of opinion, and that future can only happen with your help. So, if you can, throw a few bucks our way. With 7 billion people on Earth now, just think if 1 in a million gave us just $10, we'd have like, let's see, 10 bucks times 1,000 divided by 7, carry the, it would be a lot of money.
Welcome back to the Stephen Spearer Show, live from Los Angeles on TalkRadio1.com.
I am Stephen Spearer. This is TalkRadio1.com. My guest is Jim Mosqueira, author of 2020. Jim, one of the things that you talk about that emerges in the story of 2020 is the dominance of the Republican Democratic parties is being challenged like never before. How likely is it, in your view, that a third party could get traction? How would it happen? What would it take?
Well, honestly, and this is something that I've mentioned in a lot of the interviews that I have about the book, I would argue very, very strongly that you actually saw the emergence of third parties in the 2016 election. And let me explain how that is, because I think everybody now assumes that because of the polarity that exists in the country that, okay, you're either going to have A or B. And I think it manifests that way mostly. But in 2016, you had three candidates that I identified as having, for me, for all intents and purposes, third-party characteristics. One was Ben Carson. The two is the current president of the United States. And three was Bernie Sanders. And I'll explain each one. You know, Ben Carson was actually leading in the early polls. When I saw 16 candidates for the Republican, you know, side of the ticket one time on a stage. And I knew it was pretty wide open. I didn't know who was going to win, but I knew it would be very, very wide open. And he's not anyone, Dr. Carson, that in my estimation identifies strongly with the Republican Party. I think many people would argue, or it would be very hard to argue, I should say, that the current president is strongly associated with the Republican Party. I mean, you saw that during the run-up to the election and even after he is elected, where a lot of Republicans were distancing themselves from him. And he's not someone of strong ideology. Bernie Sanders called himself a democratic socialist, and he's actually listed as an independent. I would argue that maybe if the shenanigans with the DNC hack had not occurred, you might have actually seen a Trump versus Sanders final, you know, runoff. And again, there you have two candidates that I don't believe subscribe strongly to the ideology of the parties under which they ran. But, you know, I understand that they have to do that because of, you know, getting on TV, raising money, et cetera, et cetera. In 2020, in the book 2020, I discuss how the country starts to split because the populace realizes that, well, the Republican Party doesn't satisfy me, but I can't vote for the Democratic Party either. And I think you saw that very, very clearly this year, Steve, or in 2016, because you had two candidates, Clinton and Trump, that were very, very unpopular. So in the book, you actually have the Republican Party as constituted today, you have the Democratic Party, and then you have something that I call the Independent American Party, and then you have another party called the Theocracy Party. So those are four parties that, again, will, you know, have vied for offices in the United States in 2018 in the book, and then moving forward into 2020, and they present some very, very significant challenges to the election.
I so agree with you on a few of these things, and I don't see it the same way in others. I don't see a third or fourth party emerging outside the Republican or Democratic Party because of the money and the structure and all of the mechanisms that it takes to run. You know, Donald Trump ran years ago for president as part of another party. I can't remember which one right now. And he, of course, he lost. And what he concluded was you have to be a Republican or a Democrat to run. And he felt that Hillary would tie up the Democratic nomination. So he ran as a Republican. And I think largely over the years, he's looked more like a Democrat than a Republican. But what he did is he co-opted the Republican Party. And that's what Bernie Sanders almost did. He almost co-opted the Democratic Party and took over from a position outside Trump, outside Republican outside the Republican structure and Bernie Sanders outside the Democratic structure in terms of policy. Neither one of them are adherents to the standard policies of their parties. So I think the way a third party emerges is more from an internal revolution taking over the party. I think that is exactly what happened with Donald Trump successfully and what almost happened but unsuccessfully for Bernie Sanders. If that continues, What I think it reveals is the disintegration that's taking place in both parties. Before November the 8th, the advice I was giving to the Republicans would have been, you've got to stop you're going to become a marginalized party that has no power if you continue to take the radical positions you take. And since November the 8th, it's the advice I'm giving to the Democratic Party, is that you're marginalizing yourself. You've hollowed yourselves out. So it's going to be a long, long time before you're set again in position. I think this is true right now of both parties, even though on the surface, the Republicans are in overwhelming control, not only of all three branches of the federal government, but in two-thirds of the governor's offices and in 66 out of 99 chambers of state legislatures. It's overwhelmingly Republican, but I still think it looks very, very hollow in terms of core stability.
Yeah, and I will say that I agree with you in principle. It's very, very, very difficult to be elected as a third party. You know, the closest that we saw from a popular support perspective was probably Ross Perot in 1992. In the book, and you mentioned that one faction of the party kind of takes over. You know, the Republican Party right now has, I guess they call it the Freedom Caucus. It's the old, you know, Tea Party wing.
Yeah,
and in the book, I actually spun off something called an Independent American Party, which the candidate that ran in the book 2020, he actually was originally a Republican. And the Theocracy Party, if you can probably figure out, that is a party that appeals to some of the more religiously minded people in the United States who, you know, maybe they don't have a home right now. You know, maybe they are not strong adherents for Trump, and maybe they weren't going to vote for Hillary Clinton. So I think the seminal event that has to occur to maybe make my book, and again, understanding my book obviously fiction, but to make that more realistic, is something that happens within the financial realm. Because when that happens, it's how government reacts. And as I mentioned to you, people want, this is real life, people want more and more from the government. Something happens, you know, they want government to do something. And as I mentioned, that's the tension in the book 2020, is, you know, people want more and government's more than willing to give it more. When the next financial crisis occurs, how will government react? You know, how will the Trump administration react, which is what you have right now? You know, will they apply a heavier hand? And that's a heavier hand with, you know, whether that's security, you know, authority, you know, financial regulation, right? That's always a very prominent theme that comes up. And so if something like that were to happen, and now you're coming into the real election of 2020, you know, would that be a possibility then for the Democrats to resume control of the White House? And again, these are just questions that I'm bringing up. But what makes that happen in the book is, again, that sense of financial instability, and also the instability that people feel in their own personal lives from, you know, being insecure from cyber threats or kinetic threats.
Well, you're absolutely right. When we had the September 11 tragedy in 2001, we were in an economic high. And when we had the economic crash of 2008, we weren't in the middle of attacks, either cyber or kinetic. But if we have the coincidence of the two together, I think that the premise of your exploration in 2020, I think is correct, because as much as most people look at the government and don't have today great confidence that it's efficient or effective or can get the job done, that's who people generally will turn to, especially in a cyber or kinetic attack, and even in an economic circumstance, to say, what are you going to do about this? And people are looking to Donald Trump. The people who voted for him are looking to him and thinking, what are you going to do to create jobs? And he keeps saying he's going to create jobs. Do you think the president, any president, can do that?
Absolutely not. And that, unfortunately, and you mentioned earlier when you introduced your show about having people, you know, with this plethora of information that's out there, really applying the critical thinking skills. And again, to revert back to the book 2020, that's something that that Chandler's mentors talked to him about, is that people believe that government has these magical powers, that they can sprinkle fairy dust as they orbit the Earth and everything's well. And that just simply doesn't happen. And in my nonfiction books, I even mentioned that if you hear a politician ever say, well, I'm going to create a job by doing this, you know, run the other way, because that just simply doesn't happen. The government has no money of their own. It comes from somewhere, and that somewhere is taxpayers. And when that threshold gets breached, it comes from the debt markets. And obviously now, you know, we've got a significant debt crisis that faces us with funded and unfunded liabilities. So no, the president doesn't have any ability to do that. And the premise of Escaping Oz series is that I want people to, very much like Toto did in the Wizard of Oz story, they need to pull back the curtain and they need to look in, you know, behind that curtain so they can see that the wizard that's pulling the levers and pushing these buttons is nothing but an ordinary man. There's no magic that's there. And when that moment of reckoning happens, you know, that's when all kinds of, you know, political things can happen and instability that is kind of alluded to in the book 2020.
I am convinced that about 80% of the people in the United States are not on the fringes. They're not far right. They're not far left. I think you've got about 10% on the right, far right, and 10% on the far left, but that the 80% in the middle, and I certainly count myself among them, would look and say some combination of what the Republicans want and the Democrats want, something that tends more toward smaller government involvement, both in the bedroom and in social issues, and then on economic issues, less involvement, smaller government doing less, I think is what most people want, to the extent that they have the information that government, when it operates, doesn't really operate very well.
Yeah, I don't know, Steve. I might have to differ from you. I think that 80-20 Pareto rule, you know, principle that you're suggesting right now, I think I've seen some articles where, you know, people have in the past, and now let's go back 10, maybe 20 years, that they were more in the middle, but now there's more polarization where people identify more strongly with, I don't want to use the word extreme, but a position that's more towards one side and the other. I think you're seeing that in social patterns. I mean, I read a book one time that talked about how, you know, you have red states and blue states, that now there's just even a greater concentration of red counties and blue counties. And I'll throw a little blurb out for the third book in the series, which is going to be probably coming out within the next month. It's going to be called Division, which is, you know, the book 2020, the book Rebellion, I mean, these things happen. You know, what's the consequence of all of this? You know, what's the end game? And the reader will see that in the third book in the series, where, you know, everything's just stretched really, really tight. And there's there are secession, you know, strong secession movements, you know, physical secession. There's cyber secessionists that get introduced in the second book. That really, really fascinating concept, in case anybody's ever read about that. And there's a real thing that's actually trying to happen right now, which is called an Article 5 convention. I talk about that in the second book a little bit, and it comes into play big time in the third book. So you got the country just kind of really, really being stretched again because of these, you know, this polarity. I say the word polarity, it's not just, you know, positive and negative. I mean, it's being stretched in multiple directions, and you see that a lot in the third book in the series.
I think that the vast majority of people are not that political. They tend to look and say, what am I going to do with my spouse, my life partner, with my children, with my parents? How am I going to enjoy my time? What am I going to do for fun? How am I going to provide for myself in my old age? What am I going to do to solve problems that come up on a daily basis, make myself feel safe and comfortable? I think they look at that, and then I think to the extent they're interested in politics, I think it's actually more removed and remote. I think that it appears to me that the biggest problem we have in terms of politics is apathy, and most people don't know what apathy is, and they don't care. It's a removal from this, and they end up being in that middle 80, in that center 80%, that the people who are dynamically far right and far left are getting so much more publicity, and they respond to surveys, and I think it skews polls. It makes polls inaccurate, so we can't even rely on them the way we used to.
Yeah, that I would agree with much more, that there is an incredible amount of voter apathy. And with the book that I just finished reading, the name escapes me right now. The author talks about that in great detail, that, you know, that apathy, because people get very, very caught up in their daily lives. And, you know, being an author, I kind of understand more how it's very, very difficult to command attention. Again, as I mentioned earlier, in the era of 140 characters, you know, people getting more news obviously from social media these days. So it really, really requires, you know, much more critical thinking today, as you mentioned in the intro to your show, probably more than ever, because the information overload is overwhelming. And so you really need to know how to separate the wheat from the chaff. And I would agree with you that there are some very, very strong influencers that exist at the polls that are probably driving a lot of the agenda, and again, trying to move that mass of 80% in the middle.
What do you hope, Jim Mosqueira, that your readers will come away with after they read not only 2020, but Rebellion and the new book that's coming out in another month, which again is called?
Division.
Division. After your readers read all three books, what do you hope they come away with?
I want them to be entertained. Obviously, there's social messages that are transmitted through some of the characters. I don't want to necessarily talk about those right now because I want the readers to be able to discover them. I want them to see, you know, what a potential path is, you know, for the United States. Again, this is fictional, but again, it's a potential path. But some that have read it so far, the very first book, they say, yeah, this is just hitting way too close to home. It's interesting. I had a review on the second book, Rebellion, from somebody that's from across the pond in the UK, and she made the same comment. She's like, this is a little bit too scary, like almost too believable. And this is somebody from – and I didn't write it with the intention of trying to satisfy a British or, you know, European audience. It's really directed more toward the United States. So I want people just to, you know, just to have an understanding of, you know, something that potentially could happen, and to try to really understand that, again, that tension between, you know, the freedom of something and the freedom from something, you know, what's important with that. Again, become more aware, obviously, of cyber threats in the future. Be open to, you know, third party politics that may be, you know, something that occurs in the future. I think it was one of the founding fathers, George Mason, that said that he anticipated that most of our elections would actually be decided in the House of Representatives, because there would be many competing factions, you know, that nobody would necessarily, you know, win the Electoral College vote. So, yeah, just becoming more aware of, you know, some different things that could happen, you know, be open to third party politics, understanding a little bit more about freedom and liberty, and just kind of enjoying the journey that Chandler Scott has through the different books, and kind of see him grow and mature, you know, not just in his love life, which is a small part of it. I don't want people to think it's a big part of the story. It's a small part, you know, kind of balancing that act of, you know, his love, his work, you know, some of the challenges that he faces, the more responsibility that he feels, which we talk right now a lot in the news media about, you know, alternative news, fake news, alternative facts. We've heard all that. That's something that I talk about in the third book, which is, you know, the responsibility of the journalism profession to, you know, be that fourth estate, you know, try to provide, you know, good information, you know, for people so they can make their own decisions, not necessarily. I mean, they provide some interpretive aspect, but ultimately, you know, they're there to be, you know, truth tellers, right? I mean, we think about Walter Cronkite, Chet Huntley, and, you know, David Brinkley, and those types. You know, when they reported on something, I don't think there was that same sense of, well, you know, is this fake news, alternative facts, whatever. So the journalism profession comes into play also in the third book.
Jim Mosqueira, thank you so much for being with me today here on TalkRadio1.com. I very much appreciate it. I look forward to having you back a fifth time.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Steve. Good to be with you this morning.
Thank you, sir. So, ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been Jim Mosqueira. And this book, you know, you can hear it in as Jim describes it. He had fun writing this book. I'm having fun reading the book, and I think you will too. You can buy it here now on the TalkRadio1.com website. Thought-provoking, compelling, engaging, something that will cause you to think about all of this in a way that we can all learn. Ladies and gentlemen, when I return, there appears to be a trend away from having brick-and-mortar offices, and I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about how likely that is and what it's going to mean to business and realtors and office rent and the price of parking, and also what I think of the whole idea. I'm Stephen Spear. We're live from Los Angeles. Back in less than 60 seconds. Stick with us.
Live from Los Angeles, you're with the Stephen Spearer Show. Back in less than 60 seconds. This is TalkRadio1.com. Sure, you love the fine programming on TalkRadio1.com, and you want to help make sure we stay here. Now you have another avenue of support by doing what you're already doing, buying stuff on eBay. Just like our relationship with Amazon.com, when you click our link on the TalkRadio1.com homepage before you buy, every purchase gives back a little bit to us, and it doesn't cost you anything. Our costs have recently undergone a significant increase, and your support is more important than ever, which is why we're exploring new ways that you can help us when you do what you're already doing. Shopping on eBay has never been easier or more secure with their Get the Item You Ordered or Get Your Money Back with the eBay Money Back Guarantee. So before you buy stuff at the world's largest ongoing auction, eBay.com, use the eBay link on the homepage of TalkRadio1.com. It's time to talk real estate with real estate attorney Stephen Spearer, live from Los Angeles on TalkRadio1.com.
I am Stephen Spearer. This is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, March 18, 2017. And there was an article recently that drew something to my attention. I think we all know that there's a trend away from having brick and mortar offices. And what that's going to mean, I've heard a lot of things in the media about what that means to the prices of real estate. And I think a lot of those are true. But this struck me. This is an article by Karen Jordan with BizNow out of Los Angeles dated March 9, 2017. I'm just going to read a couple of sections from it. She says, for many of today's companies, where they and their employees are working is often less important than the work they do. This emphasis on the final product, particularly in the tech field, but also in others, is driving demand for companies that operate more in a virtual space. The pendulum has been swinging in recent years, with many big corporations, including Best Buy, IBM, and AT&T, opting for more of a results-only work environment where employees do not have to be physically at work. According to Purdue University's Krannert School of Management Associate Professor of Management, Bradley Alge. The benefits include workers being able to balance work and family and being flexible about where they can work. More than 70% of employees of corporations would be willing to trade easier commutes for better office environments, according to CBRE research. That approach sometimes extends to the structure of the corporate offices, as more companies not only allow employees to work from home or more flexible locations than a traditional office space, but also are growing with departments and workers spread across the map. Well, we're certainly seeing this, and I know that when employees now apply for jobs, they're looking for different things than they were when I started 39 years ago with hiring our first employees. Questions are being asked now that we never dreamed we would hear, we never thought we would hear, but we're hearing them. Potential employees in a job interview asking, what about flex time? How strict are you about what time we come and go? If I need a mental health day, can I just take one? Questions like, how often can I work from home? And this is what we're seeing tremendous offerings by, especially the larger companies, that people can work from home with the idea that if you work from home, you have some freedom. And a lot of that ends up translating to, well, it's kind of like a day off, but it is or it isn't. And I'm not sure it ends up creating the freedom that people think it does. I think it may create an illusion of freedom where they're off at 2 o'clock in the afternoon so they can go to their kid's soccer game. And then they're opening email at 11 o'clock at night, going to sleep at 2, getting up again in the morning to do it all over again. It's not clear to me that the flexibility is what it appears to be. So that's one thing. this fellow, Bradley Alge of the Purdue University Krannert School of Management, is quoted in the article, says that law firms are not going to be ideal fits for virtual setups, and FaceTime is a value no matter the profession. In general, collaboration is important in a lot of companies' cultures. Well, that's right. As an operator of a law office, I will tell you that it just wouldn't work to have people not there. We drop into one another's offices. There are people who have an office 20 or 50 feet away from mine. I might not see them all day. But when we need to talk, when we have to get together and speak, being in person is a tremendous advantage. Being able to drop in or pop in for a quick conversation and strategy or tactics in a particular situation is critical. The conversations that take place walking by one another in the hall or standing in the kitchen make a great deal of difference, and they have another effect as well. More on that in a moment. Going back to the article, the trend of these types of work environments began in the early 1990s with the e-commerce boom, according to Bradley Alge. While it preceded the millennials, he said, they now do not know it any differently. It's almost expected they'll have the ability to work from anywhere on any device in any location. He says the disadvantages to having this the brick and mortar office includes costs associated with having commercial real estate and infrastructure. When you have a smaller virtual office and you probably rent those spaces, you can mix and match and adapt and change much quicker than if you get tied up in a single physical large corporate headquarters type of situation. Well, that's great. But then he goes on, I think, correctly to talk about the limitations. He says, one of the biggest limitations and disadvantages to having virtual organizations is there are times when you're going to have to get together. There are times when you're going to have face-to-face conversations. As the organization grows in size, the coordination of the organization needs to grow as well. Well, that's exactly right. And when you have meetings with clients as a professional, whether you're a lawyer, an architect, a physician, a CPA, any number of different professions, there's no substitute for face-to-face contact. People understood this better 100 years ago when the telephone was invented and became more prevalent, and people were writing articles in journalism of the day saying that it will be the downfall of society that people are talking on the phone instead of in person. Well, it wasn't a downfall, and it has a lot of advantages, but it's not the same as being in person. Now you see people all the time sending emails or texts to substitute for real communication, and they think they have a relationship with someone because they keep tabs on them on Facebook. This ends up having a deteriorative effect on relationships and on communication. And the people who I see who are thriving in creating business relationships and some kind of dedication are doing it in person. One of the things that this article says is, another challenge is the potential of never establishing a strong corporate culture. So one concern on the virtual organization is, do you have a culture? And if not, that could be a threat. Well, that's for sure. One of the fundamental things that happens when you go to residential care facilities or independent living or assisted living is they will tell you that if you have to give a new resident, usually talking about senior citizens, a period of time, usually around 90 days, to get there and form new relationships. What happens is that an entirely new social structure occurs because we're social animals. When we get to a residential care facility or independent living or even assisted living, there is a situation where you form relationships over meals, over playing games, over seminars, common experiences, and you form a new social structure. This is also seen when kids go away to boarding schools. Kids who go away to boarding schools, generally their parents are told, don't have any contact with your kids for the first 2 weeks and have minimal contact in the first month. And then you can have periodic contact, but know that the center of their life is in the boarding school. A lot of reasons to go and not to go to boarding school. But once that transition is made, a new social structure emerges. I've got two more examples of this. If you look at the television show Survivor on CBS, now in its 34th season, the entire idea behind it is that when you take away the social structure, who is in the corner office, who's the boss and the executive versus who is working on the factory floor, when you take away all that structure and put these people on a deserted island where they need to survive the elements and then survive each other in a game that involves outwitting, outplaying, and outlasting people, that a new structure will be formed. It's a social experiment where a new structure is formed, and the people who were in leadership elsewhere typically end up in leadership here as well. So what happens is, again, a new social structure is connected. Final example is in any office environment, when you see someone who loves their job, they'll tell you about the work. They'll tell you about making a difference. They'll tell you about the pay and the benefits. They might tell you these days about flexibility, but what they're going to tell you is that it's the people at work that they work with. That's where the culture structure exists. If you have everyone working alone in their own homes or sitting in Starbucks working alone, you do not have a culture, a corporate culture. You don't have a unified culture. And it creates a circumstance where it's very difficult to have any kind of stability or loyalty. People shift, they're independent, they seek multiple sources of opportunity, and there is no loyalty. Now, if you're running a company where that doesn't matter, then you won't care. And if you're running a company where people don't make any difference in the organization because it's all run by robots or automatic computers doing different things that you don't need people for, you also won't care. But where you need people, and professional offices are probably the primary example of this, you can't export to the internet or export to China or India what you are doing in a hotel or in a restaurant for customers. That has to be done personally and directly. If you're a lawyer, a doctor, a dentist, an architect, a CPA, those things are very difficult to do in terms of any type of quality advice or relationship without direct contact. And so I think that the trend away from office, yes, it's going to affect and depress real estate prices in office. And I think in coming years, you'll need fewer offices, but it's never going to disappear completely. It's never going to even substantially disappear, because enough people in business are going to draw the conclusion after a while that they have to have the same type of foxhole loyalty that you have in the armed forces, where people are fighting, yeah, for their country, yes, for freedom and the American way, but they're fighting for the person next to them. That's where the unity is. That's where people say, I love this job. That's where people say, I'm loyal to this job. It matters to me. It's not just interchangeable with another job. And so the whole idea of remote commuting, working at home, flexible time, I think that concept is not going to carry in the long run in most places. My thanks again to Jim Mascara, who joined me this day to discuss 2020, a political thriller. I recommend this book. I'd suggest that you buy it. You can buy it right here, right now on the TalkRadio1.com website. I think another thing I would suggest is that you take a look at Jim's other books. Very, very worthwhile. He wrote Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During the Financial Crisis, and Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. Now, you might think that some of the material would be dated because it's talking about a crisis that is now very different and evolved. But what you find as I went back and looked at those books before today's interview is that they contain a lot of great wisdom and insight that makes a lot of difference for helping you figure out what you're going to do with your money, with your career, what comes next. So, all of those books. My next show will be 1 week from today, and my guest is going to be Dr. Sarah Gorman. She's written a book called Denying the Grave, Why We Ignore Facts That Will Save Us. And this is a book about decision making. That's next week, a week from today, Saturday, March 25th, 2017, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. My email address, steve@talkradioone.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. Throughout the country and around the world, this is talkradioone.com.